This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.
You're listening to audio from one of our Third Thursday webinars on Parkinson's research. In these webinars, expert panelists and people with Parkinson's discuss aspects of the disease and the Foundation's work to speed medical breakthroughs. Learn more about the Third Thursday webinars at michaeljfox.org/webinars. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I'm Brian Roberts, Michael J. Fox Foundation patient council member, and your moderator for today. Today, our panelists will discuss what causes OFF when symptoms aren't well controlled, how to manage this often challenging time, and treat these fluctuations. And I think of interest to many listeners, the therapies that are in development to smooth out these cycles. Let's meet our panelists. Like I said, I'm Brian Roberts. I'm on the patient council. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease when I was 30. Our next participant, retired associate dean from Ithaca College's School of Business, Barbara Howard. Barb was diagnosed in 2011 at age 55. Barb also knows real pain and suffering as she's been a season ticket holder for the Buffalo Bills for over 20 years. Welcome, Barb.
It's actually over 25.
No one deserves that. And that's coming from a Mets fan. Glenn Batchelder is a biotechnology entrepreneur and member of the Michael J. Fox Foundation Board of Directors. Welcome, Glenn.
Glad to be here.
And our final panelist is Dr. Sarah Horn. Dr. Horn is a board-certified neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania and a SAFRA Fellow in Movement Disorders. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for having me.
So, we have a great, knowledgeable, and diverse range of panelists to talk about OFF episodes. What we'll cover today is what is OFF, why does OFF happen, how do different patients manage OFF, and I think the devil's in the details there. Some extremely interesting and innovative ways. And then finally, what are the new therapies in development? And things are quite promising for the future. And I think you'll want to really hear what's in the pipeline. So with that said, let's begin. Let's start with defining what is off time. I think once we have a definition of this, we can move forward with shared understanding. But off time means something often different to each, depending on where you sit in the Parkinson's spectrum of care. Dr. Horn, why don't you start us off with how do you define off time?
OFF episodes are whenever the benefits of levodopa wear off and there's a return of the Parkinson's disease symptoms in between doses. The textbook definition is a levodopa dose lasting less than 4 hours, but practically speaking, I think of it as whenever the levodopa dose doesn't last until the next dose is due. These usually begin several years after diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, and they're due to progressive disease combined with chronic use of levodopa. Some risk factors that we know that can contribute to developing off times are a younger age of onset of Parkinson's disease, longer use of levodopa, and higher doses of levodopa.
So what Dr. Horn was stating that with OFF, there were both motor and non-motor symptoms that occur. And we're going to delve into these throughout the hour. So, Barb, as a patient, what is off time for you?
Well, as Dr. Horn was saying, that off times can be either motor related or non-motor related. And I guess off times are also different for everyone. I'm sure many people have heard the expression, if you've met one person with Parkinson's, you've met one person with Parkinson's. So they vary a lot. Again, as she mentioned, tremor, slowness, stiffness, gait, balance issues. During off times, those become more bothersome. But for me, the non-motor symptoms are actually what are my sort of my biggest Achilles heel, if you will. And it actually took me a while to grasp that what I was feeling was actually a part of my Parkinson's. So I do get slow, and I lose some dexterity. But for me, I also get sort of foggy-brained, a cloudiness, unfocused, moody, and very anxious. I think Dr. Horn mentions anxiety attacks, panic attacks, kind of thing. And it's sort of annoying from an individual standpoint because I can feel myself getting grumpy or feel myself getting down, but you can't sort of stop it. You can't sort of just turn it off. So that's very difficult. My voice becomes quieter and words are not as clear sometimes. Or sometimes I sound like a 13-year-old boy going through puberty with my voice cracking and raspy. It's funny, at our house, between my husband's poor hearing and my speech communication, we joke whether it's just it's my speech or his hearing. The other thing, too, is that I think that for me, the off times can be either very shallow and last a short period of time, or they can be longer and what I call deeper, where the symptoms seem to be more intense. There seems to be more of them. And obviously, the deeper and the longer it is, the more impact it has on my daily activities. For me, most of them may happen right around my dose of medicine time. So you sort of know predictability. But again, that can be 10 minutes before my next dose. It can be an hour before my next dose. This is sometimes, it has been as much as an hour before and an hour after. So it can be very difficult and very frustrating. When my medicine works, it works very well, and I have few symptoms. So to have an off time is tough.
So, Barb, if I could just follow up. When you say you go off, there's we'll call it different depths, you feel? Would that be the proper way to describe it?
Yeah, I think in some cases the symptoms feel very minor, and they're and you don't become as slow. I don't become as moody, if you will, kind of thing.
Sure.
And sometimes especially the longer the off period lasts, the more intense it becomes, the more sort of noticeable the symptoms are.
Interesting. Thank you, Glenn. As someone who's been on the therapeutic development and the kind of the business of bringing treatments to patients, how did you, or what did you see off being for these individuals? What was the lived experience? How would you define it?
Well, thank you so much. So I come from sort of the unique perspective of having founded a company focused on developing therapies for off episodes. And it's probably worth noting that we sold the company. I no longer have any financial interest in it. It's just an area where over the time I was working, I really have become passionate about. And so when we started the company, we had this technology that could have addressed a whole series of different disease-associated challenges. Hey, Brian. So I was just talking about the the drug development perspective of off episodes. When we were looking for where to focus, we spoke with many Parkinson's patients, and we came to realize just how impactful off episodes were on patients' lives. And as many of them said to us, it wasn't that their underlying medications didn't work. It was really not knowing when they would let them down and sort of leave them stranded. And we also heard that, the more high pressure the situation, the more consequences if they were sort of turned off in the situation and worried about it, the more likely the episode would occur. And this was really at the heart of what was making patients change the way they lived. And so we were really struck by this as an area where this uncertainty, this inability to sort of plan your life as in the way that they have over time was really something that inspired us to focus on off episodes and try and give patients more control of their life back.
Great. Now that we've talked about how we define off, why does off happen? So, Dr. Horn, how do you see the, I won't say cause, but the myriad of reasons, why does off happen in patients?
Right. So I'll start by talking about kind of what happens in the brains of people with Parkinson's disease. So we know that Parkinson's disease causes dopamine depletion in the brain, especially in the deep parts of the brain called the basal ganglia, which is very important in the circuitry that controls movement. And as the disease progresses, there's this loss of dopamine, and that in combination with how the brain reacts to doses of levodopa combined to cause these motor fluctuations over time.
When a person is going off, is there a typical time it takes, or is it very individual?
So like most things in Parkinson's disease, it's very individual. But commonly, whenever people are first starting to notice that they're experiencing off times, it'll happen towards the end of their dose. They'll notice that if maybe they're a little bit late on their dose, they'll notice their Parkinson's starting to reemerge, and then as time goes on, that'll happen earlier and earlier.
Great. And I think you said something that many Parkinson's patients come to realize, and just about everything is very individualized with Parkinson's. There are some commonalities, but the lived experience tends to be different for everyone. Now, Glenn, what about the gut? What role does that play in this?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So from somebody who works with trying to make better drugs, that L-DOPA is this remarkable drug, you know, partially because it, in the end, replaces exactly what your brain is missing, the dopamine. But one doctor said to us as we were sort of beginning this journey of trying to figure this out was, you know, in terms of maintaining those consistent level of dopamine, L-DOPA, you know, not too high so you don't trigger the potential dyskinesia, and not too low so that you turn off, he said, you really couldn't come up with a more challenging oral drug or a more challenging disease in Parkinson's disease for this situation. So the reason is because L-DOPA is what you call a neutral amino acid. So amino acids are the things that make up proteins, these little blocks. And so because of that, L-DOPA only goes from your gut or your intestines into your blood in a very small part. It's called the jejunum. Otherwise, it just, you know, sits within the intestine. And therefore, it's, you know, in contrast to many of the drugs out there where anytime they're in your stomach or along the way, they're going into your blood. So it gets hung up there. And as Parkinson's disease progresses, for example, your stomach will, what they call, empty more erratically. So it may push the L-DOPA through very quickly, or it may hang it up there for a long time and it doesn't get in. And when it does go down along the way, and it reaches the jejunum portion of the intestine, it competes with all the other amino acids. So if you've ate some meat or other proteins, those are going through the same pathways and can keep the L-DOPA from getting in. So all of this creates the situation where in terms of time and how much gets in, it's a real challenge to predict. And if we come back to what Dr. Horn was just talking about, having a consistent level is extremely important. And the further along you are with the disease, the more sensitive people get to that level, and hence part of the hypothesis of why people have these off times. And we in the drug development business call that, you know, that oral delivery of L-DOPA, the oral gauntlet. It's just a very, very challenging thing to do. And so a lot of what people think about in terms of developing drugs is how do you create that more consistent level?
Great. Very interesting. We want to take your questions as we go through the hour. I think now might be a good time to take our first question. And this question will go to Dr. Horn. Dr. Horn, does exercise help decrease off periods?
So exercise in general is really great in Parkinson's disease. I recommend pretty much all of my patients to pick up a regular exercise routine whenever they're diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and then to continue it really for the rest of their lives as best as they're able. And we have some research that's been done on exercise in Parkinson's disease, and we know that it helps in a lot of areas, including mobility, walking, activities of daily living, mental health, mortality. I don't know of any specific studies that have been done looking at off time specifically, but I think that in Parkinson's disease, people who exercise regularly generally feel better and may be able to better tolerate their off times. The caveat is that sometimes people notice that stress, be it kind of emotional stress and anxiety or physical stress like exercise, can actually trigger off times. So that's one other consideration to think about when thinking about off times and exercise.
Barb, as someone who exercises with a regularity, does it sometimes make you feel more off while you're doing it?
I generally try to plan my exercise when I think I'm not going to be off. But, yeah, there are times when if I have a particularly ambitious program at hand, that as I complete the program, as I, you know, whether it's on the elliptical or whether it's doing some running or whatever, I will start to feel myself going off. And it's not unusual for me to sort of have to counter that with, the timing of it. So it does happen. As Dr. Horn pointed out, it's not every time that I exercise. So it's different not only from person to person, but even from day to day.
And for those of you listening to the webinar, you may be seeing a theme of unpredictability. And I would argue that is probably one of the hardest things about off. It comes when it comes, and it's often hard to schedule life around it. But the one advantage of having Parkinson's is you have a long time frame to learn to manage many symptoms, I think. And exercise is one. I've started skateboarding, which I would not recommend, because when I go off, I really go off the board. Like my 7-year-old said, Dad, this was not a good idea. So lesson learned. If you don't have a 7-year-old to manage your off times, there are other ways to do it. Let's talk about how individuals manage off, and perhaps how we talk about it as well. So, Barb, give us a little context. What is your day-to-day like now versus, let's say, 5 years ago? And how does that impact your off times? Does it impact it? What is life like?
Well, 5 years ago, I was an associate dean in a school of business, and I was in 40 to 50-hour work weeks. They were very stressful positions, and that's been pretty much my standard throughout my career. It wasn't long after my diagnosis that I could tell that this stressful environment was not a good environment to have Parkinson's in, and vice versa. So I found that the more stressful the situation, the more my PD symptoms impacted my daily life. Now that I've retired, I still keep very busy, but I have more control over my schedule. So I volunteer 8 to 12 hours a week at a local hospice house. I sit on a zoning board of appeals for the town. I'm active in the local United Way, Women's Leadership Council. And I travel both with my husband and to see my 1-year-old granddaughter. So I haven't, I haven't become, sort of housebound or not willing to do some things, but I try not to fill my days with too many activities. I don't make appointments early in the morning when I know it's going to be tough for me to get up and get going and be there. I recognize that, there are certain times during the day that I have a higher probability of an off time than others. And so I try to work around those. Again, as I mentioned, I try to exercise at a time during the day when I'm generally in a good on position. One of the things that for me, recently, just in the past few months, I have been more apt to tell my family and friends when I was actually experiencing an off time. So I may turn to my husband and say to him, I'm off. And that sort of has been good because sometimes it's not physically obvious to somebody, it's physically obvious to me, my brain is foggy, I can feel myself being moody, I can feel all those kinds of symptoms. But they're not necessarily visible to everybody else. And the fact that they now understand, that's been very helpful because they've been able to support me through those tough times. Another thing, I take my medicine and schedule is, we've heard previously that, the meals, the eating, and the combination of eating and the food, sometimes it doesn't work well. So I try to make sure that I stay on a, not rigid, but sort of an accommodating schedule so I'm not taking medicine and eating food basically at the same time. And then one of the things that I've had to do over the past few years is to adjust the timing and the dosage of the Parkinson's medication itself. So working with my doctor, we've made adjustments to both the timing and the medication a couple of times. I mean, it's never a panacea, but right now it has minimized my off times. And obviously anything else that keeps the stress out of your life is good.
Barb, I just want to get back to what you were talking about with communication. Can you talk a little bit more about when you decided to tell your close friends, your husband, so on and so forth, that you were going off? Did that lessen the severity? Did it lessen the time? What was the outcome?
It's hard to tell because I still have relatively, minor off times right now, but I haven't really had a period of time when it has been really off. But it's more comforting and it's less stressful for me. So my guess would be that in this period of time that they probably are shorter. Unfortunately, it's hard to tell. We did a medication adjustment at about the same time. So it's the combination of the two certainly has been helpful. The fact that I can turn to my husband and say, I'm off, and have him sort of understand what that means to me and potentially means to him. Usually he's the bearer of the grumpiness kind of thing. So I think I just the fact that they understand and, that support, I think it's helped a lot.
Thank you, Barb. And full disclosure to everyone listening, Barb and I worked together at Ithaca College, both as associate deans. I couldn't tell when she was off because school of business deans are always grumpy and irritable. But thank you for the clarification, Barb.
anytime. Grumpy Brian.
Dr. Horn, you've worked with a myriad of patients at different times of the disease. How do you work with them to manage off?
Right. So there are numerous options to help reduce the amount of off time a person is having a day. And often, mm-hmm. I'll use multiple different strategies in combination to really help optimize the symptoms. One of the first strategies I usually recommend is decreasing the time in between levodopa doses. So, for example, if somebody is taking 2 tablets of carbidopa levodopa 3 times a day, I may have them try 1.5 or 2 tablets 4 times a day. Trying to be particular with how they're spacing it, so maybe 4 hours in between every single dose. The downside to this is that you have to remember to take more pills a day, and higher doses of levodopa can cause side effects like hallucinations, dyskinesias, sleepiness, nausea. But the main benefit with sticking with carbidopa levodopa is that it tends to be predictable and effective. There are newer formulations of carbidopa levodopa on the market that sometimes I'll use as well. Rytary is a newer extended release version of carbidopa levodopa, and each dose lasts longer. So people don't have to take it as many times a day, and then it can also reduce off time. However, there are some downsides. It can be difficult to convert to Rytary, and the process sometimes can take weeks, and it can also be expensive. Levodopa is a gel form of carbidopa levodopa that's infused continuously into the gut. This requires a surgery to place a tube, which is similar to a feeding tube, into the stomach that then is advanced into the small intestine. And this can be a good option for people who have more severe on-off fluctuations that aren't well controlled with oral medications and who also are not good candidates for something like deep brain stimulation surgery. Since it's a continuous infusion of levodopa, it can really help smooth out those on-off fluctuations. But the downsides are that it requires surgery, and there's a pretty high complication rate in people who have tried Duopa, such as infection and clogged tubes. And then the device is external to the body, so people who have Duopa have to carry around and manage the device all day. Another option, besides using different strategies of carbidopa levodopa, is to add on a different type of medication to carbidopa levodopa. And these generally reduce the total daily off time by around 1 to 2 hours. MAOB inhibitors decrease the breakdown of dopamine, and COMT inhibitors decrease the breakdown of levodopa. So they both kind of act to give a boost to the carbidopa levodopa that you're already taking. These meds are generally pretty well tolerated, but they can worsen dyskinesias, hallucinations, and other side effects from carbidopa levodopa. And then there are some things to consider with these medications. So, for example, MAOB inhibitors can't be mixed with many over-the-counter cold medications and have to be stopped before surgeries. And COMT inhibitors sometimes cause explosive diarrhea and orange urine. So those are just things to be aware of. Dopamine agonists are another class of medications that can be added to carbidopa levodopa to reduce off time. These can be easy to take because they come in once daily pill formulations, and then there's also a patch formulation. However, there are some caveats. This class of medication tends to have a higher risk of side effects than other medications for Parkinson's disease, so they're not right for everybody. Some side effects that people experience include compulsive behaviors like excessive gambling or shopping sprees. It can also cause sleepiness, including sleep attacks, and increase the risk of hallucinations. And the risk of these side effects increases with age, so I generally avoid prescribing these medications in people over 65 or so.
Well, there's certainly a range, and we're going to continue talking about the ways we can manage off in a few minutes, but I think it may be a good time to take a few more questions. And we have one that many of you have asked. It's trending. So, panelists, this one just came in. Do treatments treat the non-motor symptoms of OFF, too? Do any or all of these treatments treat the non-motor symptoms of OFF, too?
That's a great question. So, in people who have non-motor OFF symptoms, meaning that their non-motor symptoms fluctuate with their levodopa doses, then these treatments can help with that. There are some treatments that do not help with non-motor OFF symptoms. The main one that I think is worth noting is deep brain stimulation surgery. We commonly use that to treat people with Parkinson's disease who are having a lot of on-off fluctuations, but that one really helps with the motor fluctuations and not the non-motor fluctuations.
Great. Thank you. We have another question. How important is it to take your medication at the exact interval times? Barb, how important is it?
Well, from my viewpoint, it's critical. I actually use the alarm feature on my smartphone to remind me when it's time to take my meds. As Dr. Horn mentioned, that when you know, one of the options is to take them more frequently. And so for me, you know, that's 4 or 5 times, 6 times a day kind of thing. I really do think it's very, very important. My friends and family members are accustomed to my, you know, smartphone beeping on an irregular basis kind of thing. They're good about reminding me. If I forget to take my medicine within a very few minutes, the likelihood of an off time for me is considerably higher. It's exponentially higher. And the off time is usually longer and deeper if I'm more than a few minutes off my schedule. So to me, it's a good thing to do. And the thing is, too, if you stick to your schedule, I think it's easier for the doctor to suggest modifications. If the doctor, you know, if you're consistently coming off at, you know, 3.5 hours, or you're consistently coming off at, you know, 2.5 hours, or whatever it is, that helps them decide, you know, what the next step might be for you in terms of changing your medications.
That's
so the
good
answer,
advice.
The short answer is take your medication on time.
Yes, as admittedly the world's worst Parkinson's patient, I can speak to the other end. I frequently miss doses. I don't ever sit on a regular schedule, and I fully understand that life would be much easier for me if I played by the rules. And one day I will, but I'm also a Mets fan, and, you know, I remain one, so life is hard by choice. But thank you, Barb. It's funny, the patients I work with, even the individuals on the patient council, those who are disciplined, and I think discipline is important with this disease, they simply do better at every stage. All right. Let's go back to talking about off. Glenn, we often hear that language matters when describing off. From your experience, what is a shared, let's call it an off vocabulary, and why is that important for all of us to speak about off the same way?
Well, I think as everybody has highlighted, this is a complicated disease in terms of each patient being different. So the more, when we talk about things, you know, they can use a common vocabulary, and it makes the, I think the our hearing from patients, it really made a difference in terms of the communications with the doctor. For example, when we started, or I started, you know, sort of focusing on this area back in time and learning about it, there wasn't a real clear vocabulary. Some people would call it, you know, sort of just wearing off at the end of a dose, you know, and that some people would take these episodes to be that their medicines weren't potent enough, and they would then start to describe something different to the doctor, and other people would talk about an off episode, and sometimes, in fact, the physicians weren't entirely clear what they were talking about. So I think one of the things, actually, the Michael J. Fox Foundation has been very helpful with, from my perspective over this time, is helping to clarify that language, is because these off episodes are often this very unpredictable event, and that unpredictability is such a critical component of what makes them important to address. And so I think the clearer the patient and the doctor are with each other, and the more they can use the language of sort of an off episode as opposed to the sort of how the medication is performing overall, it seems to make a big difference from what we've heard from patients. And one of the ways one of the doctors in the field had helped me visualize it, he said, you know, there's really two things we do. We try and pave a smoother road, which is this notion of, you know, keeping everybody in a very stable condition. And the second is filling in the potholes, finding ways when the medication starts to fail, finding ways to sort of quickly fill up that pothole. And for me, that visualization has really been helpful over time.
That's an excellent way to talk about it. I hadn't heard that, but it makes a lot of sense. Thank you. So there are many different ways to manage off. We covered multiple. Dr. Horn, can you just touch upon one other? I'm going to move this slide forward. The injectable Apokyn. Can you just talk about that option, please?
Right. So I think of Apokyn, or an injectable form of apomorphine, as a way to fill in the pothole, like Glenn was mentioning. So this is usually used on an as-needed basis. And it is a medication that's in the class of a dopamine agonist. And it is injected into the stomach, upper arm, or upper leg, similar to somebody would inject insulin. And it acts very quickly. Onset can be as soon as 10 minutes. It's pretty short-acting, so it needs to be kind of used in combination with the other Parkinson's meds that a person is using. But it can be good in certain situations, such as whenever people have unpredictable or severe offs, including really severe morning off periods. It does come with side effects. Nausea and vomiting can happen with this, and so sometimes people even pre-medicate with an anti-nausea medication. It can also lower the blood pressure and cause dizziness. It can increase the risk of hallucinations and can make people sleepy as well. But in certain situations, it can be a very helpful medication.
Great. Thank you. Before we move forward, we have another popular question coming through. If we're talking a person to person, and again, we know about the variability of this disease, are there times of the day where off is more likely? Or, again, does dosage and let's call it likeliness, is that really a more individual-specific experience with off?
I think it can be individual experiences and different between patients, but it's not uncommon that off times can be bad in the morning because it's been a while since the last dose. And then also sometimes people find that towards the end of the day, their off periods are worse. So there are some relationships that some people notice as the day goes on.
Yeah, and Brian, I can actually, I concur with that. That's very typical of my, if I'm going to have an off period, it's more likely that it will happen in the morning than the early afternoon or early evening. And later, the later the day gets, the more likely that I will have an off period of time. So I think that that's probably a pretty typical pattern.
Hmm. Yeah, it does seem it is quite individual specific, but I do hear that mornings, late afternoons, for me, it's predictable. Actually, when I exert myself for physical activity, I'm an active baseball player. In the seventh inning, I always start to go off. I really can't explain why, but I would imagine I'd be playing professionally if that didn't occur. Okay. Let's talk about the future. What new therapies are in development to help us with these off periods? Glenn, you are on the vanguard of this. What do you see coming down the pipeline?
So, I think it's actually a pretty exciting time for this issue in Parkinson's disease. There's a good deal in development, and I'll touch on kind of the things that are sort of later stage development. There's some even earlier things that are still more ideas than looking like they're going to be products. But it comes back to what we were talking about a little before, which is there's really two strategies, this paving the road smoother or filling in the potholes. So, the filling in the potholes concept is, it allows patients as they start to feel they're going off, which often we hear they do know it's coming, and that technologies that are able to, in large part, bypass that oral gauntlet. So they don't have to take a drug, whether it's L-DOPA or some other drug, orally, but they can get the drug into the blood in a very quick and reliable way. So that's the first strategy people are pursuing. The second mm-hmm. is the sort of paving the smoother road, which has to do with maintaining L-DOPA, or in some cases, the dopamine levels in the brain right where you want them, and finding ways to hold it there so you have fewer and less severe off episodes. So, you know, with the first strategy, there's two potential therapies that are actually filed with the FDA, which is pretty exciting. So they, towards the beginning of next year, the FDA will decide whether to approve them and make them available to patients. So one is this idea of inhaled L-DOPA. So full disclosure, this is the one that I worked on. And
okay.
what it allows is for patients, as they start to feel like they're going off, they can inhale the L-DOPA, and because the lung is a great transport mechanism, its whole purpose is to transport, you know, oxygen, CO2 in and out of the body, it actually does a great job of transporting L-DOPA right into the blood in a very predictable way and boosts the L-DOPA levels enough to carry to the next dose. It's not replacing oral L-DOPA. It's just when it fails, when you don't get enough in, it gives the necessary boost. So that's the first one. The second one goes back to what Dr. Horn was talking about around apomorphine. So instead of it being an injectable form of apomorphine, they have developed what looks like a Listerine strip that you put below your tongue, and rather than swallowing it, it actually goes in through the mucous membrane and gets absorbed rather rapidly. And because apomorphine to your brain kind of looks like dopamine, it stimulates similar things in the brain, it then can also diminish or abort an off episode. So those are the filling in the potholes therapies that are relatively soon, we hope, are going to be available for patients. The other side is really around this paving the smoother road, and there's sort of three relatively late-stage therapies in development. One is a pill that when it gets to the stomach expands and it stays there, and it has L-DOPA, carbidopa, and it creates a sort of a constant stream into the intestine. So it takes at least a part of the oral gauntlet and makes it a little more predictable. So it's something that then would allow you to take an oral pill and then ideally hold your blood levels in that range of not too much, not too little, more effectively. The second one I'll talk about is what it's kind of an injection patch. So it's a patch, but it has sort of small needles involved so that it actually allows you to have a pump that slowly meters L-DOPA and carbidopa in below the skin, which then diffuses into the blood and sort of creates a continuous stream going around that oral gauntlet and allowing the blood levels of L-DOPA to be held in a very sort of consistent and steady fashion, again, reducing the frequency and severity of off episodes. And the final one to talk about is a gene therapy. So this is something where genes that produce a particular protein, it's called DOPA decarboxylase, but what that means is it produces a protein that takes L-DOPA and converts it to dopamine. And what has been found is that as patients progress with the disease, not only do they make less dopamine in the brain, but they make less of this enzyme necessary to break L-DOPA down into dopamine. And by implanting this gene therapy in there and having your body create essentially a new machinery for producing this enzyme, patients are able to take whatever dopamine is in the brain, and their brains are able to more quickly and efficiently and predictably convert it into dopamine. So those are kind of the three paving the smoother road therapies, and all of them have have real promise. Different, as everybody said, the different patients will respond differently to them. And so, you know, one tool isn't going to solve all of this, but I think they all contribute to the mission.
Wow. Well, it sounds like the future is bright. And I think what it gets back to, Glenn, when I hear you describe these, is predictability of life and basically a sense of normalcy, however you want to define that. So, again, individuals being able to live well and have confidence that they can manage their symptoms.
And maybe one sort of point of that is exactly what you highlighted, is it's not just the unpredictability, but it's the worrying about the unpredictability. So by giving patients things that will make them more confident that they won't have them, it probably will reduce the severity and frequency of cells, you know, to be determined. But that's a hope and a possibility.
That is that is exciting. And as a patient, I look forward to the next few years, because I think we're really going to see some impact. So it looks like we have about 5 minutes left. So I think at this time we will take some more questions. I also want to mention that almost all the therapies we discussed, the ones coming down for the future, they've all been funded in some way by the Michael J. Fox Foundation. So the good people and the hard work they do there really do make an impact on all of our lives. And I am really appreciative for all their efforts. Okay, let's go to some questions. Sleeplessness. Often many medications cause it. Is there a way to manage it? Barb, did you experience this when you were working?
Sleeplessness or sleepiness?
Yep.
Okay.
I guess they're both related.
I was going to say, actually, both. And even since I've worked, I went through a pretty long period of time where if I slept for 4 hours a night, that was, you know, that was a good night kind of thing. And then I would be sleepy during the day, and I would have daytime sleepiness, which would sometimes come on almost, you know, unpredictably, unannounced kind of thing. I would just, you know, I would be very sleepy. And the more, you know, stationary I was, for instance, in a meeting or riding in a car, those kinds of things would actually increase the sleepiness. The sleeplessness and not being able to sleep through the night, it was a little bit more difficult to address. In about the last month or so, I actually modified my evening dose of levodopa, and that seems to help. I've been getting a pretty consistent 6 to 7 hours of sleep, which is still shy of what they recommend for someone, but it does help, and that helps the daytime sleepiness. So it's something that you definitely want to check with in terms of, you know, what your doctor is doing and having a conversation, because sometimes there is something they can do to adjust the medicine at work.
And Barb, just following up on that, is that a good reason to be specific when choosing a neurologist? Maybe just not a general neurologist, but someone who specializes in movement disorders?
Having experienced both, I started out with a general neurologist and very quickly was changed to a motor disease person. And there's a big difference. You really want to have someone who is up to date and focused on the treatments, the therapies, the drugs, and those kinds of things related to Parkinson's versus someone who is more of a generalist. I would say it's very important. And I'm sure Dr. Horn would suggest the same thing.
I admit that.
Great.
I'm biased, though.
Looks like we have time perhaps for one more question. This one is pretty straightforward. Does stress cause off? I think I could build this one. I have a very stressful job where Barb may have worked 40, 50 hours a week. I work 70, 80, because I'm not as talented or smart as she is, but the job itself is very stressful. We have donor issues, we have faculty issues, we have parent issues, a lot of issues, and I can tell you that it does create perhaps more frequent off times or sometimes deeper off times, but also in a way, in a kind of odd way, I've learned to handle off better and handle stress better. So there is a silver lining to it. The repercussions of off have kind of given me perspective, which those of us in communications don't often have. So I'm able to prioritize what's an emergency, what's not. And I think I just have a better view on my life based on, you know, being off and knowing how tough that really is. Well, it looks like we're just about at the hour. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And thank you, Barb, Glenn, Dr. Horn, for sharing your expertise. Please mark your calendars for our next webinar, which is November 15th. That's right, we're already into November, where we'll play a webinar on the research year in review. And it has been a very exciting year, so you won't want to miss that. We also have staff behind the scenes at the Michael J. Fox Foundation there to answer any questions you may have live. I look forward to listening to that. Panelists, thank you so much for taking part in this today. And everyone listening,
thanks for having me.
Stay well. We'll see you in November.
This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.